We mentioned last time this observation that there's it definitely begins earlier than David, right? But there's this running tension between Judah and the other tribes. I'm sure this goes all the way back to the brothers, right? If you think about what happens at the end of the Joseph story, right? Judah is given a prominence over against his brothers that gives him not the privilege of firstborn in terms of the double blessing, right? That goes to Joseph, but the leadership that you would expect of the firstborn. But he's not the firstborn, right? Reuben is firstborn. Simeon and Levi come after him, right? Judah's fourthborn, but Judah gets the position of leadership all the way back to Jacob's blessing on his sons. So in addition to, right, Judah, in terms of the territory, Judah is in the south. Simeon is kind of swallowed up inside of Judah's territory, right? They're surrounded by Judah. We don't really hear from Simeon as an individual tribe much after that. So even in terms of the division of the territory, Judah is kind of separated from and separated out from the rest of Israel. So all throughout the rest of Israel's history, there's this tension between Judah in the south and everybody else in the north. But the curious thing we noted, as David returned, he seemed to agitate that tension that already exists. Now we could say, well, David's from the tribe of Judah, so of course it makes sense for Judah to bring him back. But this tension is intensified through David's actions, right? The northern kingdom begins the conversation about bringing David back, and so David sends these messages to Judah so that Judah can bring him back first. Well, of course, the optics are going to look bad if your own family is the last one to accept you, right, when everybody else does. But alongside that, Mike made this interesting comment, right? Do we see something of Jew-Gentile tension in this Judah versus Israel tension? I'm going to punt on that. I'll say I don't know. That's an interesting question. But one thing we do see throughout David's reign is Gentiles given prominent positions. Gentiles have prominent positions in his court. Gentiles are highlighted throughout his narrative, right? It's through the wife of Uriah the Hittite, whom it's through her that Solomon is born, right? As well as, right, David's actions with her bring so much pain to the kingdom. But already with David, there's this inclusion of Gentiles. As we come to the end of 2 Samuel, we read about the mighty men who've served under David. Many of them are not native Israelites. So as we see in Jesus' genealogies, in Matthew, as we see at various other places, right, with David, there is a specific highlighting of these foreigners. We see that elsewhere, related to David, but not in 1 and 2 Samuel, with the book of Ruth, right? Ruth, who's his grandmother or great-grandmother, who is a woman of Moab, a Moabite. So just a couple of comments there as we launch into chapter 20. Shall we read the text together? 2 Samuel chapter 20. Theoretically, right, we're moving on from Absalom's coup. David's back in Jerusalem. There's this tension between Joab and David. But David's back in the city. He has pardoned all of his enemies. Maybe. He has publicly. We'll see what develops there. And so, does he live happily ever after? Let's find out. 2 Samuel chapter 20. Now there happened to be there a worthless man whose name was Sheba, the son of Bichri, a Benjaminite. Why would that be significant, by the way? Yeah. That's Saul's tribe. Saul was from Benjamin. And also, Benjamin is on the border, right, between Judah and the rest of the tribes. So that's that geography is also significant there. Yes. Yes, so Benjamin is also the tribe that almost disappeared in the book of Judges because they stirred up rebellion, because they were wicked, because they came to the defense of one of their cities that clearly did such horrid things. So, yeah, Benjamin is a firecracker. We'll leave it at that. But it's significant that this person is from Benjamin for all of those reasons, right? Benjamin is a source of trouble. Benjamin is on the border. And Benjamin is where Saul is from. So he blew the trumpet and said, still in verse 1, "We have no portion in David. We have no inheritance in the son of Jesse. Every man to his tents, O Israel." So all the men of Israel withdrew from David and followed Sheba, the son of Bichri. And the men of Judah followed their king steadfastly from the Jordan to Jerusalem. And David came to his house at Jerusalem, and the king took the 10 concubines whom he had left to care for the house, and put them in a house under guard, and provided for them, but did not go into them. So they were shut up until the day of their death, living as if in widowhood. Then the king said to Amasa, "Call the men of Judah together to me within 3 days, and be here yourself." So Amasa went to summon Judah, but he delayed beyond the set time that had been appointed him. And David said to Abishai, "Now Sheba the son of Bichri will do us more harm than Absalom. Take your Lord's servants and pursue him, lest he get himself to fortified cities and escape from us." And there went out after him Joab's men, and the Kerethites and the Pelethites and all the mighty men. They went out from Jerusalem to pursue Sheba the son of Bichri. When they were at the great stone that is in Gibeon, Amasa came to meet them. Now, Joab was wearing a soldier's garment, and over it was a belt with a sword in its sheath fastened on his thigh. And as he went forward, it fell out. And Joab said to Amasa, "Is it well with you, my brother?" And Joab took Amasa by the beard with his right hand to kiss him. But Amasa did not observe the sword that was in Joab's hand. So Joab struck him with it in the stomach, and spilled his entrails to the ground without striking a second blow. And he died. Then Joab and Abishai, his brother, pursued Sheba, the son of Bichri. And one of Joab's young men took a stand by Amasa and said, "Whoever follows Joab and whoever is for David, let him follow Joab." And Amasa lay wallowing in his blood in the highway. And anyone who came by, seeing him, stopped. And when the men saw that all the people stopped, he carried Amasa out of the highway and into the field, and threw a garment over him. When he was taken out of the highway, all the people went on after Joab to pursue Sheba the son of Bichri. And Sheba passed through all the tribes of Israel to Abel of Beth-Ma'akah, and all the Bichrites assembled and followed him in. And all the men who were with Joab came and besieged him in Abel of Beth-Ma'akah. They cast up a mound against the city, and it stood against the rampart, and they were battering the wall to throw it down. Then a wise woman called from the city, "Listen, listen, tell Joab, come here that I may speak to you." And he came near her, and the woman said, "Are you Joab?" He answered, "I am." Then she said to him, "Listen to the words of your servant." And he answered, "I am listening." Then she said, "They used to say in former times, let them but seek counsel at Abel." So they settled the matter. "I am one of those who are peaceable and faithful in Israel. You seek to destroy a city that is a mother in Israel. Why will you swallow up the heritage of the Lord?" Joab answered, "Far be it from me, far be it that I should swallow up or destroy." Interesting comment from Joab. "That is not true, but a man of the hill country of Ephraim, called Sheba the son of Bichri, has lifted up his hand against King David. Give up him alone, and I will withdraw from the city." The woman said to Joab, "Behold, his head shall be thrown to you over the wall." Then the woman went to all the people in her wisdom, and they cut off the head of Sheba the son of Bichri and threw it out to Joab. So he blew the trumpet, and they dispersed from the city, every man to his home. And Joab returned to Jerusalem to the king. Now Joab was in command of all the army of Israel, and Benaiah the son of Jehoiada was in command of the Kerethites and the Pelethites, and Adoram was in charge of the forced labor, and Jehoshaphat the son of Ahilud was the recorder, and Sheba was the secretary, and Zadok and Abiathar were priests, And Ira the Jairite was also David's priest. What do you see? Yeah, David had made a promise earlier to Amasa, right? Mercy and clemency, that's gone. That was last chapter. All right, so we've got this fellow Amasa, right? David had made prior promises to Amasa that he was going to replace Joab, right, and put Amasa in command of his armies. How's that work out for Amasa? Not so good. Yeah, about like Abner, yeah. I like your phrasing there. It strikes you. Yeah. So Joab, as he goes about his business, let me rephrase that. As he goes about the king's business, he also goes about his own business. Good. What do we make of Joab at this point? Right? Is he a good guy? Is he a bad guy? Because he is fighting the king's enemies, right? He fights the king's enemies and his own. I like that, yeah. He's loyal to David, but never lets that get in the way of his own self-interest. Yeah. Yeah. How does David respond to this? I mean, it's obviously known, right? Everybody's walking past Amos's body until they move it out of the road into the field. And it says, right in verse 22, and Joab returned to Jerusalem to the king, right after they deal with Sheba, the son of Bichri. Now, what does David do to Joab? Joab just murdered in cold blood the man David put over Joab at the head of the army. And how does David respond? Yeah, I mean, as far as we can tell, he doesn't. I mean, I wouldn't want to have to deal with Joab at this point, given what he's shown himself to be clearly capable of. What? Yeah. Yeah, I feel like we need a body count for Joab, right? I think our counter would run out. But yeah, so he killed Abner, right? Saul's old commander, right? The commander who was in charge of Israel's forces, right, and was going to bring Israel back to David. He killed Absalom when David clearly said, right, deal well with the young man for my sake, right? He's killed Amasa, whom David put over the army in place of Joab. He's just left and right. So what do we make of David's weakness? We talked about this a little bit before, right? David seems unable or unwilling or both to rein in this general under him. Does that remind you, by the way, of anything else we've read in the book of Samuel? Yeah, yeah. So it reminds us of David's parenting, his inability to rein in his own son. Is Abner beginning to present the kind of threat to David that Saul perceived David to present to him? Whether or not that may have been true, right? Yes, so there's a clear distinction, right? David had won the hearts of the people. Joab has the fear of everyone, including the king. Yeah, so they're not parallel, but there are some interesting similarities in the situations, right? I wonder how it would go if David tried to put Joab on the run. This is true, right? We read this and we want Joab to wear a black hat, right? He's a bad, 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 bad man. But he's also one of the only people who is consistently willing to stand up to David, right? When David transgresses, Joab knows and Joab says something, right? It's a good question. Yeah, so with Absalom, right, think about Joab's actions. So with Abner, right, that's ambition, right? Ambition probably at the expense of international politics, right? That makes it harder for David to win Israel back to him, right? With Absalom, sorry, go ahead. Yes, yeah. So Abner had killed, Joab's brother had persistently pursued Abner, even though Abner had continued to try to deflect him, right? And so actually, it was Azahel, right, running behind him. And so he stuck out the butt of his spear and stopped, and Azahel ran into it, right? So yes, so vengeance. And over against peace, right? He kills Absalom. Now, he had his own bone to pick with Absalom. He didn't exactly get along well with him. Right? Absalom set his fields on fire when he couldn't get Joab to come and talk to him about coming to see the king, right? But I don't think he killed him because of that. So with Absalom, right, there's a question. Is he killing Absalom to protect David? Yeah. Yeah. So over against David's wishes. But here with Amasa, so with Absalom, is he protecting David? With Amasa, this seems to be purely ambition, right? Amasa was given the command that Joab had. With Amasa out of the way, Joab is back in command. We're also, right, these all start with A, so they're easy to remember, but we also have Uriah the Hittite, right? It was Joab whom David put in charge of putting Uriah on the front lines in order, right, and then forcing a risky maneuver that is certainly going to cost lives to ensure that Uriah died, right? And Joab knows. Joab isn't like, okay, it's because he's clearly the best and maybe this will work, right? Joab's better at strategy than that. And David's instructions were also more clear than that, right? Make sure Uriah dies, right? Charge, put him in front, charge, and then pull back, right? That's not to give Uriah the opportunity to win an extraordinary amount of valor, right? That's in order to make sure he dies on the battlefield. So, on the one hand, Absalom does these things for his own ends, although possibly also protecting David with Absalom. He's also been quite willing all along the way to do David's dirty work. to do what needs to be done that David asks for, to do what needs to be done that David also knows needs to be done but is unwilling to ask for, and to do things that he knows need to be done even against David's will. I think that's an interesting observation, Zach, that Joab believed himself to be the best possible person who needed to be there alongside David to protect David from his enemies and to protect David from himself, perhaps. I think that's a good observation. But yeah, I think there are two reasons, perhaps, for David's inability to rein in Joab. One is Joab's kind of scary, right? I mean, who's to say that he wouldn't do something to David if David were to oppose him? We look at this and we see his loyalty to David in the midst of his own interest in furthering himself, right? But I wonder if that's what it looked like from David's perspective, right? As this powerful warrior continues to challenge David at times and defy David's instructions and wishes at others. For David, that I'm sure that feels like a threat. I just lost my train of thought. Yeah, so the two times I would think that it comes closest to a direct threat are that one, right after dispatching Uriah, right? He warns David, like, you need to come and finish off this city that we've almost conquered, lest they name it after me, right? With this possibly implied, possibly genuinely cautious, right? Maybe doesn't want to be seen in the kind of light that Saul saw David, right? And then, again, so I keep losing my train of thought. It's probably the train going by. It's taking my thoughts with it. So that's the one threat, and then there's another. After he's killed Absalom, and David is weeping in that upper room and all Israel can hear him. Joab very bluntly tells him, you need to cut it out or everybody's going to leave. And you will be without the army. Right? That could be heard with the perceived threat of I and the army are leaving. I and the army that I happen to command in the field are going to leave. So there's another wrinkle in the story to David's relationship with Joab. Because who is Joab to David? Sorry? He's an advisor, but he's also family. Right? I forget the tangle of relationships, right? We just use the French cousin, right? Was this like an uncle or nephew or once or twice removed cousin somewhere in there, right? But he's a member of David's clan, a relatively close member of David's clan. So there's all of that family network and complication as part of it as well. Right? I can't believe people find this text boring, right? There's so much going on at every turn. What about Sheba? What a guy, right? He's of the tribe of Benjamin, but he's named as belonging to the hill country of Ephraim, right? So he's got the family connections that involve a possible threat to David, right? Because he's from Saul's tribe. But geographically, he's located in the hill country of Ephraim, a bit away from Benjamin, where he probably has all of these connections with these other tribes of Israel, right? So politically, he's in a great place to pose a challenge to David. He's got a claim against David. He's got connections, right? He's got an ability to move. He's got people with him, right? This could be a real challenge to David's kingship right after he's dealt with Absalom. And although the people didn't leave, the people are probably wondering what's going to become of David, right? And who fixes it? Who gets David out of this jam? Joab, right? Not Amasa, David's choice. Something happens. We don't get the details, right? Amos is sent off on this errand. It takes him longer than it should. So Joab goes. Now, we don't know what. We don't know why Amos is delayed. We know Joab meets him on the way, right? But David's plan to fix this doesn't work. Joab gets him out of the jam. Joab gets himself out of a jam along the way, right? Repositioning himself as the commander of David's army. And how do things go for Sheba? Sheba the Bichrite. Off with his head, right? He thinks he's got things going for him. He does escape to a fortified city, which is what they all fear. Right? It's the one scenario we want to avoid. Why would we want to avoid that? Yeah, like there is nothing about him escaping into a fortified city that's going to go well, right? It means it's going to take a really long time to deal with him, right? It means he's got a fortress to defend. It means he's got more people, right? And that city probably has allies in the area. So if it looks like it's the king versus this city, that's just going to fuel the rebellion that Sheba is trying to foment, right? And the optics are terrible, right? It's the king versus Israelite cities. Only that's not how it works out, right? I don't know if Sheba, right? Sheba needed a Joab who could go and sort out where to go and where he's going to be supported and where he could hide well. Instead, right, Joab seems to have this thing with women of famous Israelite cities. Like they're his friends, or he has some kind of easy relationship with them that other people don't have, right? Because he brought one to talk to David to bring Absalom back. Not that that went well, right? But here he has another conversation with a woman from a city that is a mother in Israel, and everything is dealt with. Joab doesn't even have to get his hands dirty, right? The head comes over the wall, and everybody goes home. So much for happily ever after, right? Maybe it comes in the next chapter. And then we mentioned the verse 23 to 26. Maybe this is our happily ever after. Maybe not. Right? Everybody goes home, right? Joab blows the trumpet. They disperse from the city. It's everyone to his home instead of every man to his tents. Right? It has a different ring to it. Right? Joab returned to Jerusalem to the king with the implication that the king knows what's happened and what Joab has done and does nothing about it. Nothing about it. Now Joab was in command of all the army of Israel, exactly what he wanted, right? And Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, was in command of the Kerethites and the Pelethites, and Adram was in charge of the forced labor, which should make us, should give us pause. What forced labor? What forced labor? Where did it come from? Who's being forced? What are they laboring on? Right? That's not a happy note. And Jehoshaphat, but it's also not developed, right? Just, yeah, maybe they won't notice. Let's just keep reading. And Jehoshaphat, the son of Ahilud, was the recorder, and Shiva was secretary, and Zadok and Abiathar were priests. And this really curious note, and Ira the Jairite was also David's priest. All right. Is the storm over? I don't know. We got a lot of chapters left. Shall we read the next one? Yes, Daniel. Can you develop the question a little bit? Asking about verse 3 in relation to Exodus. So your question was about Exodus 21:10. So in Exodus 21, verse 10, we have... If he takes another wife to himself, he shall not diminish her food, her clothing, or her marital rights. Is that the one you're asking about? Ah, okay. I see. So what's up with David and his concubines as he returns to Jerusalem? What does he do? Well, first of all, what's special about the concubines who remained in Jerusalem as opposed to the household that fled with David? What sets them apart? This is reaching back a couple weeks. Absalom slept with them, right? Absalom slept with them in a very public way, right? He set up a tent on the roof of the palace in the sight of all Israel. And what did we say was the political import of Absalom doing that? Yeah, shows that he is the conquering king, right? We don't see many of Israel's kings doing that, but this was a regular thing in the ancient Near East. When you conquered a territory, when you defeated a king, one of the ways you asserted your power was to take the defeated king's wives and concubines into your own harem, right? There's this fleeting note in Nathan's comments to David in his confrontation, right? That he had given your enemy's wives into your hand, right? But Absalom doesn't just do that. He does it in a very public manner. These are the concubines that David left to watch over the household in Jerusalem as he fled. And so these are the ones whom he, in a sense, puts away when he returns, right? So they have been raped by Absalom in the sight of all Israel. So David provides for them, he cares for them, but they're no longer his concubines in that sense. They're under his care and protection and provision. But he no longer treats them as wives. So. So this is an incredibly sticky situation, legally, politically, and personally for David, right? What can he do about his concubines, whom Absalom forcefully, but even so, has then taken as his own, right? For political reasons, but in clear violation of the law, right? And now what does David do about taking them back? Yeah. Can he take them back as his own wives after this? Does he bear a responsibility for caring for them? Absolutely. And so it seems to me that he does the best he can by them in the situation. The horrible situation wrought by Absalom's actions, yes, but also as the consequences of David's own sin. It would seem quite clear from the text that they no longer have conjugal rights. So, yeah, even though. Yeah, so similar to what happened to Tamar, right? She was raped, the one who raped her was killed, and she is provided for by Absalom. You wonder what has happened to her in the midst of all of this. So, because she's not mentioned again. Go ahead. Yeah. 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 You've got to wonder why David left them. Surely he knew what he was exposing them to. Yeah, like why did he leave them behind in Jerusalem? Surely he had at least some awareness of what that meant for them to leave them behind. Maybe. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. Yeah. I think we want our biblical heroes to be black and white, right? They're either all good or they're either all bad. And it's okay for them to have occasional faults that remind us that they're human like us. But those faults have to be compartmentalized, right? And they're not allowed to kind of have roots that spread out and touch other things, right? Like we know about David and Bathsheba, but that's supposed to be confined to like these two chapters in 2 Samuel, and they're not allowed to touch other things, right? Because David's not Saul. So David's the good guy, right? And we call Jesus the son of David, right? So obviously that means we have to kind of reread David with a bucket of white paint in our hand, right? And as we read the text, we find out, rather like the things about ourselves we don't want to admit, right? These guys are much, much more complicated characters than that. There is much that is worthy of praising, much that can be imitated, but there's also much that's worthy of censure, that gives us caution, that makes us stop and scratch our heads. So we're seeing that with Joab, right? Right at the beginning of the narrative, we're like, Joab is awesome. I want to grow up to be like Joab. And then we're a few chapters in, we're like, oh, no, I don't. Oh, he's an evil, wicked, bad, 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 bad man, right? And then David oversteps. We're like, yeah, Joab, tell him. That's the wrong thing to do. And then the next chapter, we're like, oh, Joab, I know you want to be the boss, but this is not the right way. Oh. And the same thing happens with David, right? When David's facing Goliath, we're like, I want to be like David, right? Dare to be a David. And then a couple chapters later, we're like, ooh, we better not dare to be a David. That'd be not good. Not good at all. And it kind of takes us on this roller coaster that reminds us what it's like to struggle with the flesh as we want to be like Jesus. Right? We can experience moments that are huge spiritual victories that are so encouraging, right? And then the next day, we can feel the old patterns of sin working their way back into our lives. Right? So we can read these stories and be so disappointed in our heroes, because they're so much more like us than we want them to be. But we can also see the way God deals with them. The way he deals with them in grace. The way he forgives their sin and continually calls them back to himself. The way he uses them despite their flaws to do wonderful things for the kingdom of God. And that can give us hope. If God can use David, my goodness, maybe he can do something with me. If God can accomplish his will through a Joab, then who could thwart him? If God can deliver Israel through a Saul, imagine what he could do through a president. Despite that leader's flaws and what they may be trying to do. The same God who's at work in this narrative on Israel's behalf is at work now on behalf of his church. So, and on behalf of you. So we could take a peek into chapter 21 and have about enough time to read it. Or we could break early. I don't know if Ann would know what to do with this. If she walks in and it's 10:02 and we're all drinking coffee instead of in the text. So this seems like a good stopping point. So why don't we pray and just have a little more coffee this morning. Mike.
Which means that the writer is doing something he wants you to really focus in on, and it slows down, and it's like, are you Joab? Yes. I have something to think. I'm listening. So, what's the narrator doing there? What is the writer doing? Why is he highlighting that? How does that reveal his purpose in the story?
Yeah. So watch the strategies the narrator uses as we read, right? Well, we know how this works without ever really stopping to talk about it as we watch TV shows and movies, right? There are times when it moves very, very quickly, right? We get this wide-angle lens, right? Like we can see the whole prairie, or we get a time lapse of things growing. And then there are times where we're zooming really, really close and things happen in slow motion and the camera keeps switching. So we see how everyone sees the angle. We get times where there are repetition, right? I think of the servant who goes to find a wife for Isaac, right? The narrator tells the whole story of the encounter at the well. And then he comes in and sits with the family and tells the story of the entire encounter at the well. And we're like, we just read this. That's because it's important. It's so important. We get that with Exodus, right? The graveyard for every Bible reading plan ever. All the instructions for the tabernacle, right? The latter half of Exodus, preview of what's coming in Mike's sermons, right? Right? That it's all the instructions for the tabernacle. And then the golden calf. And then all the instructions for the tabernacle followed. Right? Why would he do that? Why would that be included? Because of the golden calf, right? Every bell and pomegranate, every twisted linen, right? Every curtain hung, right, on one of those bars that's fitted into one of those tenons that has a base at the bottom, right, is a realization of God's promise to be with them that is not derailed by the golden calf. So what's going on here? As in the midst of all of this action, some of which happens very quickly, some of which is just summarized, now we're at this town, and everything slows down. And we see them setting up the siege. And then we see this conversation between the woman and Joab, where he calls, or she calls, he answers, they identify one another, they have this slow conversation about what is happening. Right? This is a pivotal moment in the narrative. What's about to happen, for good or ill, is just on the other side of this conversation. Either the town is going to be destroyed, or disaster is going to be averted. And we're left hanging on this conversation. It's a good question. What do we know from the narrative? I don't know my geography well enough to know where Abel of Beth Ma'aka is. We know it's in the hill country of Ephraim. Ephraim is just to the north of Benjamin. But Abel, for all his comments or her comments about it being a mother in Israel, it doesn't seem to make it onto the map. But this is a... Yeah. But think about this as a moment where we see if Benjamin's spat with the house of David has spread throughout the other tribes, or whether despite his attempt, Sheba's attempt to stir that up, it actually stops with him and the men with him. So, Mike. And careless bloodshed. And what you see in Joab is a taking of personal vengeance. He's threatened by Amasa, so he kills him. And then he wants to execute vengeance on Sheba on behalf of David. And this woman, David says, she goes to the men of the city in her will.
Mm-hmm. Indiscriminate vengeance to the one who deserves it.
Yeah.
So it's a neat picture of that distinction working out in the correction of Joab in that.
Yeah. So in her wisdom, she stems the tide of Joab's violence. Yeah, Joab's interesting. Like, sometimes he's extremely politically savvy, and at other times he just doesn't care. He has the capability of reading the situation and knowing what to do, knowing what is best. He also has the capability of sweeping that aside, especially when there's something personal involved. And having just on the way, right, executed some personal violence against Amasa. Is he primed to wipe out a city unnecessarily? Or, yeah, they are. Yeah.
Yeah. They're all surgical. Like, they're all specific. Mm-hmm.
Well, we could argue that Abner's death did involve the death of others. Not directly, but because it delayed bringing Israel back to David. But good. See how the narrator slows it down so that we can consider and ponder and also be left in suspense as all of these things are left hinging on this conversation. So. All right. Let's pray. Get some coffee. Lord, thank you for the gift of your word. Thank you for the ways it fills us with wonder. Thank you for the ways it acts as a mirror as we see in others both our own faults and your grace as you live among and forgive and form Christ in sinful people. Lord, I pray that you would fill us with wonder, fill us with interest, fill us with a desire to know your word better, that we may continually return to it and grow in grace through it, knowing that it will not return to you void. And we ask these things in Jesus' name. Amen.